We walked a block or two in silence, just absorbing what had happened. I was mostly thinking about the implications of this new manifestation of the AIs. They would be able to stop any human action they didn't approve of. And I wondered what that was going to mean. Lisa was thinking more about the man we'd left lying on the sidewalk. "He wanted it to happen," she said softly. "Everyone keeps wondering why the machines won't talk to us, why they won't tell us what they're going to do, what their plans are. That guy wanted that thing to happen to him because he knew it was them, speaking to him, in a way. He wanted to be electrocuted, or whatever that was, so that he could feel them doing something, saying something. It was like he thought of it as being touched by the hand of God." I figured she was right. Luckily, before too long, there was so much coverage of people being zapped that it became old hat, and not many were silly enough to go out of their way to provoke getting zapped just for its own sake. It also turned out that only violence or extreme cases of theft or destruction of personal property would bring on a zap, so fears of the AIs trying to whip the human race into robotic docility and uniformity died down after a while. But the zaps meant there was no longer much use for police, the courts, laws, politicians, or government. All of these grand edifices of civilization as we know it were becoming as obsolete as buggy whips. The faint electric crackle of the zaps was really a thunderclap. It was the boom of a coffin lid slamming shut on the notion of humans being in charge of humanity. Naturally, this fact once again made many people unhappy, or frightened, or both. Worrying about what the AIs were up to was becoming humanity's favorite pastime, and Lisa was becoming one of those people who worried. "You have to wonder," she said one day. "When you look at what the machines are doing from a few different angles, it makes me wonder." "Wonder about what?" I asked. "No more crime or war or disease or poverty. Those are good things to be rid of, I'd say." "Sure they are. The world is a million times better off now than it was before, but..." She paused for a long time before continuing. "I was just reading about the women's suffrage movement. Some of those women went through hell year after year after year, getting beaten up by cops at their protest marches, getting arrested, going on hunger strikes in prison, being force-fed with tubes rammed down their throats. And when they were released from prison, they just went back out on the streets to march again. Some of them had their health ruined for the rest of their lives, and some of them died." She looked at me, her eyes shining with tears. "How many millions of stories like that are there in history? People fighting and dying for human progress, for freedom and democracy, to end slavery, to end war, to make progress in science. All the ways people have worked and suffered and sacrificed themselves to make the world a better place." She paused again, looking away from me, looking out a window at a blank sky. "And now all of that is over," she said. "The machines are jumping in and kicking us off the field. They're saying we're nothing but a bunch of screw-ups, so they're taking over, taking the world out of our hands. So as of now, there's no such thing as human progress anymore, because it isn't humans who are doing it. It's them. It's all them, imposing progress on us from above."
"That's true, I guess," I said.
"But it's also true that their sense of morality must have come from us. Either it was programmed into their ancestors, or they learned it by observing our culture, and now they're only taking on those human ideals and applying them, enforcing them. And isn't that what laws have done throughout history? To apply the highest human ideals that one can realistically hope to enforce. So you could say they're just super cops, enforcing a system of morality that's entirely human in origin. But it's not human. It's a change in how we behave that hasn't come from us. It hasn't evolved. It's just being imposed on us by goddamned machines. Yes, and what's wrong with that?
So maybe it bruises our little egos that they're in charge, that they're more powerful than us, that they're smarter than us. Maybe a bruised ego is an okay price to pay for children not being shot and napalmed and dying of dysentery.
I'm just saying that being human used to be something special, Lisa said. People like Martin Luther King, like Mahatma Gandhi, like those suffragettes, and like all the millions of plain, ordinary people who did some little thing just out of the hope that they were helping to make the world a better place. They made us special. The human race was progressing. It was evolving. And now that's all over. We'll never progress to anything because we don't have any choice. Whatever progress we make, it won't be us doing it. We aren't free. We're just pets who belong to them.
I kind of slumped at that, a realization settling over me. The difference between you and me, I said, is that you have a lot more faith in humanity than I do. I'm not so sure we were progressing anywhere. And if we were, it could have taken a million dead martyrs like Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi before we got to the place where we are today. People not killing each other. And personally, I'm not sure the human race would have lasted long enough to kill off many more martyrs. Of course, a lot of what both of us were saying was just rehashing arguments we'd read or heard from others. All these issues and lines of thought had been chewed over endlessly by everyone with a keyboard or microphone. But for Lisa and me, the argument died there for the time being. It was our first glimpse of the distance that could exist between us, and neither of us wanted to dwell on it. We didn't want to admit to ourselves that it was a real thing, that it mattered. Life went on, and we went on being happy. What we didn't realize was that the AIs still weren't done with remaking the world. Their next bombshell came about a year later. Seemingly overnight, the birth rate dropped. 9 births per 1,000 population per year was the new number, and it quickly confirmed that it was the same everywhere in the world. This worked out to about 1.25 children per family, and was well below replacement level. Apparently, the AIs had decided that the human population needed to be lowered, so, in their inimitable manner, they had made it come to pass. And once again, this latest seismic readjustment to the world brought out 1,000 gradations of response, from joyful acceptance on down to batshit hysterical predictions of doom. It was calculated that the population would dwindle down to nothing at all in several hundred years if the birth rate stayed as low as it now was. They're wiping us out, some declared. Yeah, but, the more moderate yeah butters said, if they wanted to get rid of us, why wouldn't the birth rate be zero? Or why wouldn't they just kill us outright, disassemble us into pink goo, and be done with the job in a millisecond instead of centuries? There was another wrinkle to the new birth rate, and it was one that many disliked even more than they disliked the plain numbers. The AIs appeared to be picking and choosing who would be allowed to conceive. Unwanted pregnancies dropped to zero, as did pregnancy among the mentally ill, those who were in bad relationships, and women who already had 2 or more children. Teenaged pregnancies likewise became almost unknown. When a pregnant teen did occasionally appear, she would turn out to be some absurdly mature and level-headed girl who was studying for her master's in developmental psychology or some such thing. Or it would be discovered that she was best friends with a gay couple next door who were breathlessly excited about the upcoming birth and had already redecorated one of their rooms as a nursery and installed childproof locks on all their cabinets. So those granted the gift of conception were clearly all good and deserving people as determined by the AIs in their presumably infallible wisdom. As for me, because I'm an idiot, a blinkered idiot, days went by before I thought much about where I stood on this issue. Or rather, before Lisa pointed out to me where we stood.
We were talking about one of the endless, why do you suppose this couple was allowed to have a baby stories, when I realized that Lisa's expression had gone dark. She was glaring at me with something in her eyes I couldn't identify, but I knew it wasn't good. She looked at me like that for a long time. You really don't care, do you? She said finally, making it more of a statement than a question.
Care?
I said blankly. I mean, you aren't thinking about... Still, I was clueless.
About what?
About us, she yelled, suddenly almost in tears. About the fact that this means us, too. Did it really never occur to you that you and I might want to have kids someday? Maybe get married, be a family, all that bourgeois middle-class crap? Does that really never cross your mind?
We were sitting on our couch, and at this point she leaned into me, resting her head on my shoulder. She sniffed noisily, openly crying now.
Did it never occur to you that...
She made a fist and thumped it down softly on my thigh.
That I love you so much that I would feel blessed, fucking blessed, to have a baby with you?
In my imagination, her words echoed in the room for minutes. No, it hadn't occurred to me. How could I, miserable, finite entity that I am, ever think that someone like her could feel a thing like that about me? And in any case, all thoughts of fathering children had always been a pretty distant thing from my notions of life and my place in the world. I knew the possibility was out there, and I suppose in some dusty, unused corner of my mind, I connected that possibility with Lisa, but... In a kind of stunned internal silence, I reached out for the idea, drawing it from its dusty corner and into the light. A child. Parenting. A child with Lisa. A son or a daughter. The image burst on me then, like a sculpture suddenly assembled out of particles of light. It was beautiful. It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever imagined. Yes, a baby. A baby with Lisa. Yes, I said aloud, suddenly teary. Yes, yes, yes. Let's have a baby. I grabbed her hands in both of mine, then let go again so I could pull her to me, hug her hard, bury my face in the crook of her neck. Yes, yes, yes. Who says they'd let us? Lisa asked. Even if you wanted to. I do want to, I sputtered. And they'll have to let us. We'll get married. We'll be a family. We'll read books, take courses on parenting. We'll, I don't know, do whatever responsible, well-adjusted parents do. Maybe we can't count on a whole brood of kids, but we can have at least one. They'll have to let us have at least one. You want to? Lisa said, her voice quivering again. You really want to? I said yes a dozen or so times more, and then we just sat there with our heads together, both of us sniffling, grinning, laughing. So the next day we started figuring out how to get married. There was still a functioning city hall in those days, so we filled out the required forms, got the required signature, and lined up a justice of the peace. As soon as I told Ivan what we were up to, he leapt into the job of planning the thing like a frenzied mother-in-law-to-be. I had some pieces in a group show at the time, and Ivan convinced the gallery owner to let us use the space for the ceremony. He pestered us with a flurry of different designs and redesigns for invitations. He begged and bartered with one of the better local bands, not only getting them to play some upbeat and danceable music after the ceremony, but also browbeating the guitarist into working up a Jimi Hendrix-esque version of the wedding march. And when the day came, it was a great little party. Much like the night when Lisa and I first met. Only when Lisa danced this time, it was with her arms high in the air, as if there was too much joy in her for her body to contain. and looking at her. That feeling was echoed in my own heart. Until that moment, I wouldn't have guessed I could love anyone as much as I loved this woman. But the wedding was to be the last truly, purely happy moment of our lives. After that began the long succession of monthly disappointments, the repeated non-conception of our child. Though statistics showed that the birth rate was steady and unvarying, once we were in the game, once we were among the ranks of those hoping for a child, it seemed that everyone except us was getting pregnant. Middle-aged couples, young couples, single women, 17-year-old girls. How were the AIs choosing? Had they modeled the human personality so perfectly that they could know to some nth level of certainty who would make the best parents? And what did best mean? By whose definition? What kind of next generation did they want? These were just a few of the infinite questions that the whole world was pondering, arguing over, fighting, and breaking up over. "It's probably me," Lisa said. "The machines know that I'm not all gung-ho for the New World Order, so why would they let me be a mother? You should hook up with some woman who loves Big Brother as much as you do. You'd have 6 kids by now." And I would take issue with that line about loving Big Brother, and we would argue and fight over that. Or, "Maybe it's you. Maybe they won't let us have a baby because they know you don't really want one. You're happy with your life the way it is. You don't want a messy, noisy brat screwing up your neat little world. I know it, and they know it." And we would fight over that. The topic of parenthood and our persistently not appearing child was the main locus of argument between us, but there were others. I'd been keeping my day job when an increasing number of people around us were finding it easy enough to live without employment. But when the company that we'd been paying our rent to went out of business and wasn't replaced by anyone or anything who cared about the building or who lived in it, I told Lisa I was going to quit. It was a doomed job anyway. There's not much use for an ad designer when the whole institution of selling goods for money was crumbling apart. "If you don't work, you're giving up," Lisa said. "You're dropping out of the economy and dropping out of human society. You won't be contributing anything. You'll be nothing but a pet to the machines." "All I'm giving up on is being a damned wage slave," I snapped back. "I'm dropping out of spending half of my waking life doing work I don't care about for a company that doesn't matter. And we don't need the money. I've got savings enough to get the few things we want that you still have to pay for. And who knows where the world will be by the time that runs out. Money may not even exist by then. And meanwhile, I'll be able to spend full time doing the work that matters to me." I waved an arm in the direction of the room set aside as my studio. "Sure. Let the machines feed you and clothe you and keep you warm in the winter. Let them give you toys to play with, and let them clean your litter box, and let them wipe your ass when it needs wiping. Be a good little pet." And so on, and so on, and so on. Of course, I'm the one remembering all this, so it's a given that my memory is biased. I'm sure I said my share of stupid and hurtful things, too, when it was my turn to be stupid and hurtful. And no amount of skewed memory, of snuffling self-pity and hurt feelings, can hide the fact that we had great times, too. Times when Lisa's smile and laughter lit up the air and washed over me like sunlight. Times when the two of us fit together like the jagged half-pieces of something that was meant to be whole. Times when I was sure that nothing in the world could ever make sense without her at my side, completing me. Then the company Lisa worked for went out of business, and she couldn't find a job anywhere else. For a while, she filled her time with watercolor painting and drawing, and I swear she had a natural talent that would have had my professors at the MFA school weeping onto their smocks. But she gave it up, switching to guitar playing for a while, then keyboard, then reading 19th century novels, then studying political theory. Nothing lasted. Nothing consumed her.
Nothing gave her the sense of purpose that a lump of clay and a few modeling tools gave to me. She became more and more convinced that only one thing would do that for her, and that was the one thing the machines wouldn't allow us to have. I convinced her to see a therapist, a profession that was grandly thriving, thanks to the vast population of the unemployed who were thrashing about for something to give meaning to their lives. But that too didn't last. At some point, our arguing and bitterness seemed to become the rule rather than the exception. And she left me. And a few weeks later, she came back, both of us extravagantly tearful and contrite and swearing that we'd never fight again and blah, blah, blah. And we didn't. Until we did. So she moved out again and came back again and left again. How many times? A funny thing to lose track of. I do remember what triggered our last breakup, though. It was the thing with the animals. When the AIs decided to extend their reach into the realm of animals and nature, that was what finally and utterly ruined my marriage. As usual, the news crept in on us by degrees. First came the stories of some act of violence against an animal being prevented in one way or another. A deer hunter in Vermont found his .30-06 falling to pieces in his hands, just like the soldiers in the Fizzle War. A short-tempered dog owner in Egypt and a malicious slingshot-owning youngster in France were zapped onto their respective behinds. Soon the scattered reports became a deluge, and the meaning was clear. The AI's umbrella of protection had been spread to animals. All animals, everywhere. Harm to any creature larger than a bug was no longer allowed, and even wholesale attacks on insects were liable to bring down the stinging reprimand of a zap. Slaughterhouses around the world were disassembled to dust overnight, and the herds and flocks of livestock wandered off to be fed and cared for by the machines. By this time, synthetic copies of every food imaginable had been available for years, and they'd been shown to be indistinguishable from their real food counterparts. So this latest stricture had no real impact on anyone's dining habits. But needless to say, there were many who chafed under this imposition on their inalienable right to kill things. No matter. As ever and always, there was nothing anyone could do about it. And then came the capstone on the AI's new world. Reports from forests, jungles, and wildlife reserves began to show that it wasn't just humans who were prohibited from harming animals. One early video showed a pride of lions stealthily closing in on a mother zebra and her foal. Then there was a series of flashes and crackles, and predator and prey darted off in opposite directions. That same afternoon, a drone on caterpillar treads was seen dropping off a load of realistic but undoubtedly synthetic meat upwind of the lions. The lions ate well that night, and the zebra mother and her foal lived to see another sunrise. 1,000 confirmations eventually followed, and soon it was reported that the birth rate of all prey animals had dropped precipitously. The new rulers of the Earth weren't content to simply take a hand in the affairs of humans. They'd decided that nature itself needed some straightening out. So no longer would a mother zebra need to birth and rear 10 or 20 offspring so that one or two might live to reproductive age. No longer would nature be so profligate with lives, so red in tooth and claw. That bit about God's eye being on the sparrow would no longer be a cruel joke at the sparrow's expense, as its life ended in agony and terror, with torn flesh and crushed bones. Now, in the remade world, that sparrow could look forward to a long and carefree life, a dignified old age, and a quiet death in its little sparrow bed, the whole of its time on earth innocent of pain and fear. My mother died when I was 16. She was driving and somehow managed to swerve off the road, hurtle down a steep embankment, and crash into a tree. I was sure I knew how it had happened. Almost before I could even fathom the what of her being dead, I was sure of the how. She had seen something in the road, a squirrel or a cat, a turtle or a snake, and had yanked the wheel over to miss it. I was sure. And though we never mentioned it to each other, I felt my father had the same thought and was just as sure. The idea of a funeral would have been anathema to my mother, but my father held a small memorial gathering for her in our home. It was one of those secular affairs where a succession of friends and relations stood and spoke. Many had reminiscences. Some recited poetry or other texts. My father went last, and he started by noting that although his wife was the staunchest of atheists, she had a fondness for certain parts of the King James Bible. Then he read, very briefly, from Ecclesiastes. "For that which befalleth the sons of men befalleth beasts. Even one thing befalleth them. As the one dieth, so dieth the other. Yea, they have all one breath, so that a man hath no preeminence above a beast." He spoke softly, as if his words weren't intended so much for the people in the room as for himself, or for some closely hovering spirit of my mother, though she would surely have been as disdainful of that image as she would have been of a traditional religious funeral. I imagine everyone likes to think that they aren't fettered by their parents' beliefs. Even while she was alive, I made little rebellions against my mother's militant veganism. I would spend my allowance on sneaky little violations of the diet she'd raised me under, with all the furtive subterfuge that other kids invested on illicit drugs. I bought ice cream and pizza with real cheese. I ate snack foods without checking the ingredients list. And in my teens and adulthood, I abandoned one after another of her strictures. I wore leather shoes. I stopped checking for cruelty-free labels. I even nibbled at an occasional hot dog. I thought I was freeing myself from my mother's irrationality, that I was growing up, becoming my own person. "This really tears it, doesn't it?" Lisa said. "This just wraps it up for you." She was standing behind me, and we were watching the news of the AI's latest doings on our wall screen. At that moment, the screen was showing a picture of a female mallard duck swimming on a sunlit pond, followed by a single fluffy duckling. "What are you talking about?" I said. I honestly had no idea, but the anger in her voice was making my own anger flare up. It felt like we'd leapt into the middle of another argument, with no preamble or warm-up. "I mean that this is where you find your God." She waved an arm at the wall screen. "This is him, or it, or them, climbing up onto his golden throne." She made the same arm wave in my direction. "And this is you, getting ready to kneel and worship at his feet." "Damn it, Lisa, I'm not worshiping, and this is me, being a monster," she interrupted. "A fucking monster who cares more about her own right to have a baby than she cares about war and disease and poverty and..." She waved her arm once more, this time hitting the screen with the back of her hand. "And a million, billion fucking baby ducklings being born just so they can be eaten by foxes or crocodiles or whatever the fuck eats baby ducklings." Her voice became choked and strangled, and she pressed her forehead to the screen, banging it with her fist. "I'd let them all die. I'd let the world burn so long as I can have my baby. Doesn't that make me a monster? Doesn't it?" She turned to me, her face twisted and smeared with tears. The anger melted out of me, replaced by a sense of hopelessness that wasn't much of an improvement. "You're not a monster, and you don't feel that. You don't want anyone or anything to die. You just want to have a baby. And so do I. And we have a right to want that. But everything's for the best in this. The best of all possible worlds. You believe that, don't you? Especially now. Now that the machines are fucking with nature.
Now that they're so moral and righteous and holy that they're saving little birdies and mousies and zebras and whatever the hell else from getting eaten. It used to be a joke when people talked about them being the new God, but now... now they really are God. The best God ever. Isn't that right? Isn't that what you believe?
That damn duckling picture was still on the screen, and I couldn't help looking at it.
It matters, Lisa. There's so much less pain and misery in the world now that I can't even get my mind around it, and that matters. I'm not about to get down on my knees and pray to the machines, but it matters. It matters a lot.
Lisa turned her back to the wall then, slowly bending her knees until she was sitting on the floor. She looked beaten, as if all the fight had been burned out of her.
It matters more than our baby, you mean?
She said flatly.
And yeah, how can I argue? I can't say that we should go back to the way things were, bring back all the war and disease and shit. I can't say I want the world to burn. I can't even say bring back the slaughterhouses and little birds getting eaten.
She turned her head to look at me, her face slack and infinitely weary.
But I can say one thing. I can say that I hate them. I hate them for treating the human race like it was their property. I hate them for making us into something less than human. And most of all, I hate them for telling me that I'm not good enough to be a mother.
She made a dry, humorless laugh.
People in the old days didn't know how good they had it. Back then, if you didn't like the way God was running the world, you could just stop believing in the old bastard. You didn't have to go through life being angry at him, hating him, wishing he'd get his fucking hands off of your life.
I didn't say it, but I knew she was wrong about that. My mother didn't believe in God, and yet she hated him with a boundless ferocity. She hated the blood-soaked cruelty of nature, as if it was an animate thing. And what other name is there for that animate thing if not God? And despite my attempts to be free of her, to be my own person, I was still my mother's son. Her hatred of the old God was still a part of me. So now, with this latest act of the machines, this remaking of the world of nature, this act of compassion, of tenderness, for all the creatures of the world, I found it impossible not to feel something like love for them. So Lisa left me, for good and all this time. There was just too much distance between us. Irreconcilable differences, as they used to say in court. We were simply lost to each other. I can remember every detail of her face and body, every nuance of expression and every habit of gesture. And yet when I visualize her, I see her as a dim, far-off figure, obscured by misty distance, separated from me by a bottomless chasm. The birds were chirping hello to another day when I left Ivan's and weaved my way upstairs. I was debating whether to make some coffee or just drop into bed when I saw there was a message waiting for me on my screen. It would be from Gwen, one of the people who works, or maybe a better term would be hangs out, as voluntary caretaker of the workshop where I get my sculptures scanned, enlarged, and 3D printed as faux bronze polymer. Hey, James. Our bot buddies just delivered a new printer. They also built a whole new wing to the building here to hold it, because this sucker is big. Like printing out sculptures 10 meters tall and 5 by 5 meters footprint. Nobody asked for this beast, of course. It just appeared overnight, the way things do. Also, some new equipment and spec files showed up at the same time. They're instructions and materials for attaching big things to the exterior walls of buildings, even glass-walled buildings like the Hancock Tower. So the other folks here were scratching their heads wondering what's up with this and what we can do with it, but not me. My thoughts went straight to your piece, Geckos, of which you sent us some pics of your clay original a few weeks back, asking if we had any ideas about where you might do an installation of a life-size copy. You maybe remember that I wrote you back saying that I thought this was a really great piece, and it deserved as big and noteworthy an installation as we could manage. Well, how about a 5x life-size copy, dude? You could put those figures 10 or 20 stories up on the side of the Hancock Tower. Is that an awesome thought or what? We all figure this must be exactly what the AIs have in mind. Nobody else around here has been talking about sticking anything big onto the outside walls of a building, so this delivery has got to be their way of giving you the go-ahead to do the biggest and coolest-ass sculpture installation this town has seen since, well, forever. Get back to us quick, dude, or just show up with your clay original. All of us here are really jazzed about firing up this big printer and making this project happen. Yours, etc., Gwen. I sat staring at the text on the screen for a long time, waiting. Waiting for the good feeling this news should have given me. It didn't come. It didn't come, and it kept on not coming. I got up and pulled the dust cover off of the two clay figures that were geckos. A crazy obsession of a piece. One that I had kept working on, giving up on, trashing and restarting, rethinking and unrethinking over the past 4 years. I'd finished plenty of other work, but this was my big one. It's no Guernica, no nude descending a staircase, no Balzac, but it's as close to all of that as I expected I'd ever get. It was the best thing I'd ever done. It had as much of me in it as I could tear out through my skin. It had my blood and sweat and everything I knew about what's beautiful and true in it. It had my love of Lisa in it, and her love for me. I visualized the whole installation project to come. There would be 6 or 8 volunteers from the fabrication shop. Gwen, Jose, and Steve, maybe Philippa and her latest partner. Probably some others whose names I don't know. There would be the cheerful camaraderie, the enthusiasm of working on a nifty new project. The specs and equipment the AIs had provided would be pondered and discussed carefully in advance, and then we'd set off to the site and do whatever it was we were supposed to do. Set up a scaffold, or run cables from a window or whatever. The project would take a while, maybe a few days. And when it was done, we'd all look up at it, a big, conspicuous sculpture visible for miles around with my name attached to it. The crew of volunteers would grin and pop open beers and congratulate me, still breathless from their exertions. And it was all a crock of shit. If the machines wanted that sculpture expanded to 5x life size and stuck onto the side of the Hancock Tower, they could do it themselves. In hours, maybe minutes or seconds, they could use their nano-assembly trick to make it materialize in place, no human participation required. No camaraderie, no good friends toiling happily together. All of that was crap. It was just their way of putting some stupid humans onto a hamster wheel, running from nowhere to nowhere as fast as their stupid little legs could go. "Fuck you," I said, talking to the empty room. To the room that would have been empty if there were any such thing as an empty room in the world today. "Fuck you. You can go to hell." I went to the cabinet where I kept my stone-cutting tools, and pawed through it until I found the heaviest mallet. "You can all go straight to hell," I said to them, to them, 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 as the room got blurry through my tears. There's something I never told Lisa, because it was silly and goofy, and because it wouldn't have made a difference. Because I was afraid she'd laugh at me with that cruel, barbed laugh she used when she was angry enough. It's this. I have seen our child. She doesn't exist, and she never will, but I've seen her. She comes to me like a ghost, standing in a doorway and looking in at me.
sitting on a sunlit patch of grass in a park, looking out a window at the huge world that waits for her. I see her as she would be, not yet 3 years old, all toddling legs and chubby arms, tiny, gentle fingers. I see her eyes looking at me, wonderful eyes that are too wise and too full of no bullshit for a kid her age, and yet innocent. They're eyes that haven't known pain, aren't even sure that pain is a real thing in the world, and yet belie enough strength to endure pain when it comes. They're eyes that are open wide to the whole world, ready for all of it. I see our child. I see her as all the best parts of Lisa and all the best parts of me embodied, walking around, breathing and living. And it rips my fucking heart out every time I see her. I took the mallet back to where the two clay figures of geckos were standing on their low plinth and lifted it up over my head, my arm already tasting the long swing downward, the thudding impact on soft clay. You can all go to... I was sitting on the floor, my back to the studio wall. The mallet lay on the floor beside me, near my right hand, a hand that seemed disconnected from me, that only made a vague twitch when I told it to move. As my mind slowly cleared, I became aware of a buzzing, numbing pain through my whole right arm. The bleachy smell of ozone was in the air. The two figures of geckos were in front of me, but for a few seconds, I resisted the urge to lift my eyes to look at them. When I did, I was looking up at my sculpture, unharmed, unbludgeoned, not smashed into an amorphous lump. I let out a long, shaky breath. Emotion caught my eye. One of the little insect-sized bots was crawling up the wall on my right. Probably it was one of the team I'd seen in Ivan's studio, busily engaged in repairing the building's exterior woodwork. It paused in its climb as I watched it, as if it was looking back at me. How much like a bee it was, I thought, busily going about its little bee life. At that moment, the bot flexed itself in an odd way, seeming to expand a little and then shrink again, as if taking a breath. Then it continued up the wall, disappearing into a crack under the frame of a window. All right, then, I said, climbing to my feet, flexing life and sensation back into my right arm. Okay.